number 21-2024, Amarin Pharms Incorporated against Hikma Pharmaceuticals USA Incorporated. Okay, Mr. Cazenil.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the court. For my first time ever appearing in front of this court, I'm going to focus the argument today on four broad themes. One, fraud. Two, mistake. Three, abuse of discretion. And four, institutional integrity. Based upon these four—
What about standing? Your client under the case law doesn't have action here. This is not a derivative suit, correct?
Correct, Your Honor, and thank you for that question. I will address standing. This is not a derivative suit in the formal sense, but it is like a derivative suit. It is derivative in nature. It's clearly not a direct suit, but it is derivative in nature. And in a case such as this, remember, we're going under Ninth Circuit law. There are two specific exceptions where standing is granted. One, when there is privity. The shareholder corporation relationship is one of privity. Two, when there are allegations of fraud. These are specific exceptions which allow standing to bring a Rule 60 motion. So if a non-party's interests are directly affected—
You're claiming standing or cause of action because of the shareholder's interest in the corporation. We've rejected that in the Starr case, various state courts in Delaware, and your clients incorporated in New Jersey, not your client, but the corporation is incorporated in New Jersey, all say that the shareholders can't bring a separate suit. It's a derivative suit. How do you get around that?
Okay, I'm glad you asked that, Your Honor. Thank you. The Starr case is actually distinguishable here, and I reviewed the Starr case. The Starr case, the plaintiff only alleged a direct action. The plaintiff in that case did not, it was not derivative in nature. This is, we're not alleging.
You agreed earlier this was not a derivative.
It is not a formal derivative suit, Your Honor, because a formal derivative suit involves filing a complaint, starting a whole new lawsuit. It is derivative in nature. And I would cite to the court the Intel case cited in our brief, where in Central District of California, where the shareholders were allowed to intervene under Rule 24 to argue on behalf of the corporation and secure the rights of the corporation. So I just want to make this clear that this is not a direct suit, and that the Starr case is distinguishable for that fact. So based upon that, and again, that's only the privity ground. We also have the fraud ground. And this, as set forth in our brief, we allege fraud in this case via
the— But you're trying to vindicate the rights the company in which your clients hold stock, right?
Yes, the rights of the company, but also their individual protected interests. We allege three under in our Rule 24 motion. We allege three specific substantially protectable interests that justify the intervention in this case, but we are trying to— it's a hybrid, Your Honor. This is a very different kind of case, and I'm not aware of almost any kind of case where shareholders actually brought a Rule 60 motion after the company refused or showed no interest in bringing a Rule 60 motion. So there isn't a direct precedent for this type of intervention, yet the law in the Ninth Circuit on standing and on intervention allows us to intervene here, again, on the grounds of both privity and both the fraud allegation.
What Ninth Circuit case says that a shareholder in a non-derivative suit has standing because of its interest in the corporation?
The cases for standing we rely on are In Re La Sierra and Ayuk Village, Native Village. Those are the standing cases. But in the on the Rule 24 intervention, it was a protectable interest. Again, the Intel case in Central District of California found a protectable interest where the shareholders can argue and protect the right of the corporation to recover damages. So those are clearly the precedents that we're relying on for this to allow this specific kind of intervention and standing in this specific case.
Are all your clients shareholders?
Well, as it says in our introduction, the majority of the POTI members are in fact Ameren shareholders, the overwhelming majority. But there may be people that, for instance, are part of a POTI who are involved, say medical professionals, people that are believe in the benefits, the medical benefits of the SEPA. But this is really the rank and file of this organization are shareholders in Ameren who were gravely affected when their patents were invalidated on March 30th, 2020.
But just to be clear, not all of your clients here are shareholders.
Well, again, I can't vouch for every single member. This, as we were forthright in our brief, Your Honor, it is an ad hoc organization. It's not an LLC. It's basically a bunch of people who have, as it states in the mission statement at the very beginning of our statement of the case in the brief, it's a bunch of people at a grassroots level who are for the most part Ameren shareholders, and who believe in large part in the benefits of the SEPA and seek to promote the benefits of the SEPA.
If your clients had such a cognizable interest in the action, why did they wait so long to do any of this?
That's a great question, Your Honor. Yes, we are late in the game, but we have to look at the timeline set forth on pages 14 to 15 of our case. All right, let's go through that timeline of our brief, rather. Let's go through that timeline.
You're more than late. It seems to me that the game was over.
Not for purposes. We're within the time for Rule 60, Your Honor. Again, it has to be taken in context.
You're looking to undo an unfavorable decision. Apparently, if they have the type of interest that you claim they have, then they knew of the lawsuit, they watched it, waited to see what the outcome would be, and then after they found out they don't like the outcome, then you're seeking to join and to participate in a way that it seems to me you should have done from the very beginning.
Understood, Your Honor, but that's not how this unfolded. Because there were two things that happened that after the judgment was entered, the case went up on March 30th, the case went up on appeal on April 2nd. In the Ninth Circuit, that appeal divests the court of any jurisdiction to hear a Rule 60 motion. Subsequent to the verdict and the judgment, it was discovered on August 5th, 2020, the Kerfman paper came out showing that the the reliance upon Morey in the district court's decision was mistaken. It was a statistical mistake. Thus, this was discovered while the case was on appeal, after judgment was rendered. Second thing, the crop table in Kobayashi. The crop table did not appear until defendants post-trial proposed findings of fact at page
That table was in the record in the district court, correct?
The table was part of the record in the district court. The entire table was part of the record in the sense that it was exchanged in discovery. And I know from the previous appeal, the Ameren appeal, it was part of the appendix. I do not believe it was introduced into evidence.
Shareholders are normally represented by the corporation. The corporation actively participated. The corporation decided to make a Rule 60 motion. Why is it that you suddenly can take issue with the corporation's strategy after the case is over with, seek to intervene and raise a Rule 60 motion? If you didn't think the corporation was doing an adequate job, why wouldn't you have intervened early? This would create a situation in which shareholders and any corporation could, after the fact, say, oh, well, they didn't make the arguments we thought they should have made, so we're going to bring a separate claim under Rule 60.
Your Honor, I understand where the court is coming from on that. However, this is not this case is fact specific to this case. These facts are unique here because it doesn't have to deal with inadequate representation while the trial was going on. We could not have intervened any earlier than we did because, again, the grounds for the Rule 60 did not emerge until afterward. The Kerfman article didn't come out until after the case was on appeal. The crop table, while it was in the proposed post-trial findings of fact, it took a while to figure out exactly what was going on there. Even to this day, Your Honor, in the district court's opinion, despite the fact that we laid out the evidence of fraud very clearly in our moving papers, the district court said that there was unsubstantiated claims of fraud. So the district court didn't even figure out what was going on here. It took us a while to figure out. Once it was figured out, a demand letter was served. Remember, in an abundance of caution, in case this was considered, and it is derivative in nature, but if at some point we filed and they moved to dismiss based upon the failure to make a demand under New Jersey's derivative laws, we made a demand. A demand was made by a lawyer who's an Apati member and asking that Ameren file the Rule 60. Under that law, we have to wait 90 days. That demand letter was served on November 9th, 2020. The 90 days passed in February 2021. We filed in March of 2021. So under the facts, I'm not seeking to enact some broad principle allowing shareholders to reopen every single case. What I'm saying is in this case, we have a rather unique situation because of the article that came out after the trial and the discovery of the crop table, the fraud on the court after the trial.
The discovery of the crop table after the trial is totally accurate. You conceded the supposed crop table was in the record in the trial itself.
Yes, it was in the record in the proposed findings of fact. But just because it's there doesn't mean that it was discovered or the significance or figuring out the significance of it. Is discoverable. We submitted we had to figure out, okay, is this, it's crop, what's the significance? We had to go find an expert to confirm.
That's a responsibility of the parties in the litigation to look at evidence that's in the record and to base argument on it or to assert that evidence before the court. The fact that this evidence was in the record and nobody did anything about it doesn't mean that there was fraud or an abuse of discretion here.
Well, just the fraud exists whether someone did something about it for the party or not. It still exists.
And you can't have fraud where you're aware of the facts.
You can have, most respectfully, Your Honor, you can have fraud if the district court relies on facts that are not true. The district court.
What is your argument? Are you arguing that the district court committed fraud?
No, I am not arguing that the district court. I am arguing the district court made a mistake.
Are you arguing that the parties committed fraud?
Yes. By cropping that table, yes. And by their expert, Dr. Heinicke, making a scientifically disingenuous statement, which is contradicted by the Kobayashi study itself. And with that, Your Honor, I see I've went over.
Well, let me just take just another minute or two on the merits. I thought your argument was that this was essentially newly discovered evidence that could not have been previously considered, and therefore there must be a way in the interest of justice of the correct result of finding a way of bringing this evidence before the court. Is that correct?
Yes, it is. It is within newly discovered evidence. Certainly the scientific article proving the statistical mistake on Maury was newly discovered evidence. That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay, well, as you can see, there are obstacles on the standing issue. Let's hear from the other side on this issue, and if need be, we'll take up the other points. Okay, Mr. Barabas.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. May it please the court. Jim Barabas on behalf of the defendant appellees, Dr. Reddy's and Hikma. Your Honors, we are in a very strange situation. This case was over. Obviously, the district court came out with its ruling in March of 2020. We had argument before this court in September of 2020. This court affirmed under Rule 36 the district court that the patents were invalid, I believe about a day after or 6 months after all of that. In March of 2021, Mr. Kasnoff and the EPA Drug Initiative first moved to intervene. So I want to speak initially to timeliness. Timeliness is an inquiry that the court has to consider for both intervention as a matter of right, as well as permissive intervention. And this court is reviewing timeliness for an abuse of discretion. It'd have to find that the chief judge of the District of Nevada, Judge Miranda Due, abused her discretion in making a timeliness ruling. And obviously, that's a very high standard. The court can reverse for abuse of discretion only if there's a clear error of law, there's a clear error in the findings of fact, or if there's a definite and clear conviction that the court made a clear error of judgment. So turning to timeliness, the Ninth Circuit courts look at prejudice. They look at the stage of the case, and they look at the length of and the reason for the delay. And taking prejudice first, the prejudice here is obviously enormous.
Let's assume that the 90 days applies, and let's get more to the substance of the issues we've been talking about.
Okay. So I'm sorry, Judge Newman, what specifically did you want me to address in terms of the substance?
Well, the question is, what do you want to address?
Sure,
what do you feel needs to be addressed?
Yeah, no, I mean, I just feel that I was giving the court basically an easy way if it would like. If the court agrees with Judge Due's timeliness ruling, there's no intervention as of right, and there's no permissive intervention. And the ruling on timeliness, you look at prejudice, the stage of the case, and the length and the reason for the delay. The prejudice is enormous, as I think Your Honors have noted. The stage of the case is the stage of the case was over. And the only thing that had not happened, and it happened 3 months later, is the Supreme Court denied a petition for writ of certiorari. But the case this court had ruled in this case, it affirmed the district court 6 months before the EPA Drug Initiative moved to intervene. So, and then finally, in terms of the length of and the reason for the delay, we heard Mr. Kastanov's argument there, and one issue there is we're not looking at whether it would have been appropriate for Ameren, a party, to move under Rule 60 to vacate the ruling. Mr. Kastanov and the EPA Drug Initiative are not a party to this litigation. So, and he was clearly aware of and following this litigation for a very long time before he moved to intervene. And you have a duty to intervene as soon as you become aware you have an interest in the case. And we know that, for example, this court had denied Mr. Kastanov and EPA Drug Initiative's attempt to file amicus briefing at the Federal Circuit. That was 6 months before the intervention motion. So at least 6 months before, Mr. Kastanov presumably could have done something. So if the court agrees again on just the finding of timeliness, which this court's reviewing for abuse of discretion, there's no intervention as of right, and there's no permissive intervention. And then if I could turn briefly to Rule 60, Rule 60 requires that to move to vacate, you've got to be either a party or a representative of a party, absent extraordinary circumstances. And Mr. Kastanov and EPA Drug Initiative are neither. He's not a party. The parties are Ameren, Dr. Reddy's, and Hikma. He doesn't represent the party. Ameren was represented at every stage of this case by a very prominent national law firms. And so then we turn to what are the extraordinary circumstances? Well, I've heard two theories this morning. We're talking about, privity and a virtual representation would somehow give Mr. Kastanov a right to move to vacate under Rule 60, and also fraud. And with respect to the first argument, privity, for Ameren to have been a virtual representative would have required, among other things, that Ameren provided adequate legal representation. But we've heard very clearly from Mr. Kastanov this morning that Ameren did not provide adequate legal representation. And in fact, Ameren did not make the arguments that should have been made about some particular reference in the litigation. So given that he's arguing for purposes of intervention that the representation was adequate, and then here he has to argue that the representation is, he's arguing that representation was inadequate for purposes of intervention. And then he's arguing here, he has to, by definition, argue for virtual representation that the representation is adequate. I mean, the theories are kind of at war with themselves. And I'd note in Mr. Kastanov's own briefing, he's admitted that he needs intervention to do anything under Rule 60, because otherwise he's not a party or a representative of a party. But clearly the privity argument fails. With respect to the fraud argument, even if we assume, and this is something obviously we all, as the defendant appellees, deny fervently, that there was any fraud, much less fraud on the court or anything of that nature. But regardless, that's not Mr. Kastanov's and EPA Drug Initiative's claim to bring. Fraud requires, to bring a fraud claim as a non-party, you would have to suffer some direct harm. And Mr. Kastanov's own briefing admits that they've suffered no direct harm at most their shareholders. They suffer only indirect harm as shareholders. And that's, for example, the Rothenberg case, which is cited in the briefing. So he does not have standing to bring, fraud claim as a non-party. So to address the question, Judge Newman, that you had posed about how do we come in with newly discovered evidence, there's no standing, and there's simply no way for Mr. Kastanov and EPA Drug Initiative to do that. So unless this court has any questions for me, I have nothing further and will submit.
Any questions for counsel?
No.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Kastanov. You have rebuttal.
I have another concern, and that is I'm not sure that you complied with the required disclosure rules because you have not disclosed to the members of this ad hoc group. And I don't think the rules contemplate avoiding disclosure by forming an ad hoc group and then hiding behind the name of the ad hoc group. You're muted. We can't hear you.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
I was on mute during counsel. Sorry, I apologize. Your Honor, certainly, if we had to, I mean, if the court required it, we could list the members. But I'm not sure if there's a requirement that a group has to list all of its members to intervene or.
Well, that would mean that you could form an ad hoc group of interested people and avoid disclosure. That seems to me not consistent with the rules.
Right. But, well, no one's trying to avoid any disclosure, Your Honor. I assure the court of that. I'm not sure if there's an actual disclosure requirement to list every member of a group. But in any event, let's
your group is more a loose coalition than any type of legal entity, right?
I think that's fair to say, Your Honor.
So wouldn't you have to show, if that's the case, wouldn't you have to show that every individual of that coalition has a congressable interest in the litigation?
I'm not so sure we'd have to show that, Your Honor. Whether the law requires each individual, that seemed to me that would be a burdensome requirement for.
Well, I mean, but you list their names and then make a general assertion or a general statement of interest. But you haven't done that. That's why I was asking earlier whether your members were your clients were all shareholders, and the answer was no. Now I would understand what type of congressional interest a shareholder would have in the case, but just Jane Doe and John Doe walking down the street, what interest would they have? I would be.
I understand what you're saying, Your Honor. I just can't personally vouch for every single member being a shareholder, but the overwhelming majority of the individuals in this group are in fact shareholders. So let's just.
We can't even know that because we don't know who they are.
We describe who they are. Certainly, if that's something, I could absolutely supplement the record with them listing individuals if that's what the court would require before rendering decision on this matter. Coalitions, maybe not in this specific area, but coalitions and groups like that often in environmental cases, for instance, attempt to intervene and are granted standing routinely, especially in the Ninth Circuit, where there are a lot of those types of cases take place.
Yeah, but the coalition members are identified.
Okay, but we did comply with the requirement. When we filed, for instance, in Nevada, we did have the a member sign off on the filing of the lawsuit, we could easily identify, again, supplement the record by identifying those members if that's necessary for the court. I'm just not aware of any specific requirement under case law or court rule requiring specific identification of specific members, even in a loose coalition such as this. If there is such a rule, I would gladly comply with that rule. It's just I didn't see such a rule as we were preparing this filing. If I may proceed to some of the other, are there any other questions on that specific issue?
No, please, we're short on time. Please give us a summary of the issues.
All right. I urge the court to look at the Smith case in terms of the issues of timeliness and Rule 24. The Smith case cited in our brief, not even mentioned on the other side's briefs, because the wrong standards have been argued by the other side in terms of timeliness. The issue on timeliness is the date when we should have been aware that the interest would not be adequately protected by Ameren. Now, and this is an important point, it dovetails with the adequate representation prong. Under the adequate representation prong, they were adequately represented during the trial. There's no argument there in that sense for purposes of Rule 24. However, once the newly discovered evidence was discovered post-trial, the demand was made for Ameren to file the Rule 60. At that point, the adequate representation did not happen anymore. There was not adequate representation, because under adequate representation in the Ninth Circuit, you look at the factors whether the party, the present party, will undoubtedly make the arguments that the intervener is proposing. The second factor, whether the party is capable or willing to make such arguments. The third factor, whether the intervener would offer any necessary elements to the proceeding that the other parties would neglect. Under Ninth Circuit law, we have satisfied those points, because the fact is we made a demand for Ameren to adequately represent our interests in this case, and that demand was not responded to. So the present party is capable but unwilling to make those arguments. Therefore, the representation is inadequate. And what does the intervener bring to this proceeding? The intervener brings the Rule 60 claims, specifically the mistake that there is not clear and convincing evidence to overrule, to validate these patents. The Mori was a statistical mistake. Likewise, the conclusion that the court drew on Kobayashi was different than what was actually in the Kobayashi document itself. And the cropped elements of the table show that the difference between the two control groups was not significant, yet the court held that the Kobayashi showed significant benefit with EPA.
As the intervener, as I recall your brief, you're not requesting a new trial. You're asking this court to decide, based on what you've just repeated, that the decision of the district court should be vacated. Is that correct?
That is our most opportune, pristine remedy, the best case scenario, Your Honor. But I want to make it clear: if the court is not inclined, the court has discretion on how on it, the court has the discretion to grant that remedy. But the secondary remedy, if the court was to find that we had the district court abused its discretion on standing and intervention, this case could be remanded for the district court to then hold a hearing, a full plenary hearing on the Rule 60 issue. So that's another option for this court.
You didn't mention that in your brief, as I recall. It was quite firm and should just vacate the district court decision.
Well, Your Honor, that's an excellent point. Keep in mind there are two district court decisions. There is the original district court decision, and then there is the second district court decision, the one where we tried to intervene. And the second district court decision, in its substance, only addressed the intervention and the standing. It did not address the Rule 60. So, again, if I could have been more clear in that, I apologize. But in terms of vacating, the court, the pristine remedy is to vacate the original decision. But if the court is not inclined to vacate the original decision, the court can vacate the second decision. Vacation of the second decision, meaning the court would not make findings of fact on Rule 60, but would make findings of fact on standing and intervention, the two specific issues that the district court addressed in our intervention motion, and then a remand would be appropriate at that time.
Okay. Judge Reyna, I think you were asking a question.
Yes, I was, but I'm fine. I'm good. Thanks. Did you hear me?
Yes.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm
okay. I don't have any other.
All right.
I don't have anything.
Okay. Yeah. I'm about 5 minutes over my time. That's why I didn't say anything.
All right. Well, you could have a last sentence if you need it. Otherwise, I think we have the points. The case is taken under submission. Thanks to counsel.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
The Honorable Court is adjourned from day to day.